Welcome to Cogitations, a show where each week your host, anthropologist and UC Davis faculty Tarek El-Haik, encounters and talks with fellow thinkers, composers, philosophers, visual artists, filmmakers, and media scholars who cogitate with images, concepts, and forms. These cogitations are more than reflections. They are an expression of a way of life, an antidote to our dimmed access to the infinite, and an invitation to a joyful experience of our finitude. The show takes its name from a concept that has been key in both the philosophical work of the 12th century polymath Averroes and the interplanetary music of composer Sun Ra. Cogitations sound like the enchanting voices, songs, and music of birds of flames that have entered into our dark world. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another session of Radio Cogitation. Today, it is my great pleasure to welcome Drisk Sikas, with whom we will be talking about his wonderful and inspiring book, Au Détroit d'Averroes, at Averroes's Strait. Drisk Sikas is a Moroccan fiction and nonfiction writer, playwright, and scholar of media and culture. He has been called one of the most innovative writers in Morocco today, and was named one of the 6 best African playwrights by the National Studio Theatre in London in 2012. He is the author of numerous plays and novels, the director of Economia and the HEM Research Center in Rabat. His book, Le Métier d'Intellectuel, Dialogue avec 15 Penseurs du Maroc, The Vocation of the Intellectual, Dialogues with 15 Thinkers in Morocco, co-authored with Fadma Ait Mous, won the Prix Grand Atlas, which is one of Morocco's most prestigious book prizes. He was a visiting writer in residence with the Center for the Writing Arts at Northwestern University for the spring 2017 quarter, and was invited during 2019 to give a series of lectures in various American universities, including UCLA, Tulane, and Williams. He has been appointed in 2019 as member of CODESRIA, the Council Supporting Social Sciences in Africa, as part of their scientific committee. And his last publication is a novel, Au Détroit d'Averroes, at Averroes Strait, published by Les Éditions du Fennec in 2017. Welcome, Driss, to Radio Cogitation.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the invitation, Tarek.
So I truly enjoyed reading your book, Au Détroit d'Averroes, and I'm of course interested in talking about various aspects of the book. But when I first read the book, to me it was almost like witnessing a wish coming true. Just the very imaginative act of thinking that a book can have the title of At the Strait of Averroes gives me a great deal of intellectual excitement and an opportunity to think about why and how did your project, Le Détroit, Au Détroit d'Averroes, begun. So if you could tell us a little bit about who Averroes is, for members of our audience who are not familiar with him, and tell us a little bit about how the idea and the title of the book came about.
Well, first of all, Averroes, which is the Latin name of Ibn Rushd. When I say Latin name, it means that he has been named as such 20 years after his death in Paris, at Paris University. But Ibn Rushd, as a person, lived during the 12th century in Andalusia, in Spain, in Cordoba. He was born in Cordoba in 1126 and died in 1198 in Marrakesh. He is considered as the most important rationalist thinker within the Muslim medieval era. Just to say in few words, the fact that he is the main commentator of Aristotle, and that without Averroes' take, maybe the West wouldn't have known Aristotle as they know, you know him now. So this is very important to know. But he's not only the commentator of Aristotle. He's been also the commentator of Plato and other philosophers. And he engaged into a very important dialogue, conversation with theologians and mutakallimin, theosophians, on the importance of rational thinking and the fact that we could say, I mean, we could seek truth either through faith or through logical thinking and logical demonstration. So at the end of his life, he was exiled and excommunicated for his thinking. And then when he died in Marrakesh, 3 months, sorry, after his death, his corpse and his manuscripts, those left. I mean, it's good to know that half of his books were burned when he was excommunicated. And actually, if they survived, it's thanks to Hebraic transcription, which allowed them to be later translated into Hebrew, then into Latin. Otherwise, it would not have been known as such. So I said 3 months after his death, his corpse and his manuscripts were transported on a donkey back to Cordoba through the Strait of Gibraltar. Of course, when I thought about writing a book about Averroes, I know Averroes for a long time. I've been reading him. I've been organizing meetings and forums about rational thinking, etc., etc. I never thought I would have someday to write about him. Certainly not an essay. I'm not. I wouldn't compete with very prestigious specialists of Averroes. But writing a fiction or a sort of thoughtful fiction or literary fiction, as we say in the United States, seemed to be more and more interesting, not only to tell his story, but to tell what is left, what is left after the departure of this donkey 8 centuries ago. Why? Because the thing is, we still are fighting for more rational thinking in the Muslim world, in our countries, and more importantly, just 30 years ago in our country, under the reign of Hassan II, philosophy was banned, and rational thinking was fought under the pretext of fighting against Marxism or fighting against any sort of dissident thinking within the public sphere. So it's not only telling the story of Averroes, it's telling the story from today on what is left from this rational thinking with a back, with a flashback to the 12th century through the main character who is a who's taking a radio show and telling the story of Averroes. The title, then, you would understand that it was very exciting to find this. I mean, that was a trick, actually. Mm-hmm. That's a trick. Thinking that I would replace Gibraltar by Averroes means a lot. Gibraltar is named after Tariq ibn Ziyad. Tariq ibn Ziyad is a Berber, is an Amazigh fighter. Who conquered the Andalusia. So replacing a warrior by a thinker, replacing somebody who's fighting the other side of the sea, either shore of the sea, for conquest, by somebody who allowed the other parts of the Mediterranean Sea to discover philosophy coming from his place, means a lot in relationship to knowledge, relationship to philosophy, relationship to colonialism, post-colonialism. All these questions are beneath, I think, you can imagine the title.
You know what I find very interesting in the name replacement that you fictionalize for us in this excellent novel is also based not only on the travel of Ibn Rushd's corpse from Marrakesh back to Cordoba through the Strait of Gibraltar, but there is also a historical event that your character Adib, who is the host of a radio show that chronicles the tribulations and the travel of Averroes's ideas and an understanding of the history of philosophy. There is also an event that takes place in 1600 that you talk about. This is just for the audience, if you know you are interested in getting the book. It's on page 36 and 37, where the rector of the University of Oxford suggests to the Royal Moroccan Embassy in England to perhaps consider a name replacement. So this thin line between fiction and historical fact, I think, is quite interesting in the book. And is there anything you want to say about the Oxford University suggestion?
That's what we call the vraisemblable, the plausible but not necessarily true.
Yeah.
And besides, I was telling something which is historically true, that the Moroccan king then, Mansour Dehbi, asked the British queen her support to fight, to conquer Spain again, and she didn't answer. So I found a pretext for the royal family in Morocco not to the Sultan in Morocco not to respond to Oxford rector request.
So it's a nice mise en scène and staging of a refusal on the part of the Moroccan dynasty that was in control of Morocco at the time. But what I find interesting, and this is just for a personal anecdote for both of us and our audience, my name Tariq is actually was chosen by my family in honor to the very conqueror that your book seeks to replace, and I completely I'm on board with that project, by the way. But I think it's very interesting if you think about the taking down of statues today in the United States, for example, right? I mean, Columbus statue was just taken down a few days ago in Baltimore. Before we get into detail about, some of the, work of Averroes and this double persona of Averroes and Ibn Rushd, do you see parallels between the name substitution in your in your book? In other words, replacing the conqueror Tariq ibn Ziyad of 711 during the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula by Averroes as something that is analogous to what's happening today with the Black Lives Matter, for example. I know they are not exactly the same gestures, but is there anything that you could see and we could speculate about here briefly?
There is a concept that a post-colonial thinker, De Souza, talks about, which is epistemicide. Mm-hmm. Under the notion of epistemicide, he's talking about all the erased memories and erased heritage within the colonized countries. And actually, there is something of finding again this lost heritage that has been masked or not recognized enough as a source of building modernity from within. Mm-hmm. Building modernity from within is very important as in order to talk like Martin Heidegger, to reinvent tradition. Otherwise, actually, could be something like Erasmus for Europeans. He is a sort of pre-modern pre-modern thinker that would have allowed modernity from within.
So the one of the anthropologists who has been quite influential on my work, George Marcus, talks about the notion of epistemic partners, and I want to kind of pick up on this notion of epistemicide that you are talking about. And one of the questions that he raises in a series of articles that he published in the 1990s, he talks about the traditional interlocutors of anthropology are no longer what they used to be, right? So we are no longer just talking to non-European, or non-Western so-called primitive cultures. And he makes the argument that now the interlocutors of anthropologists are counterparts. They are equally equipped to diagnose the contemporary situation that we live in, right? And he comes up with this idea that the interlocutors of anthropologists are epistemic partners. Okay, and I like this notion of epistemic partner. And for me, Averroes and Ibn Rushd, and we will talk about the distinction soon, is an epistemic partner, right? He is a contemporary, and he appears to us as a contemporary through your book in particular. So one of the questions that I would like to ask you, in light also of some of my own, ongoing research on Averroes, I've been traveling to Italy to look at the cycle of frescoes in which Averroes is represented, defeated by Tommaso of Aquinas, right? So you know the paintings that I'm talking about. There's only one exception in which Averroes appears as a respected figure in the philosophical theater, right? It's in Raphael's School of Athens in the Museum of the Vatican. All the other paintings from the late medieval period, he's consistently represented as defeated by, at the feet of Aquinas, right? So for me, this idea of epistemic partner, of Averroes as an epistemic partner, in relationship to this critique from within that you're talking about, suggests that we need to deal with this double identity or this invitation for double critique. Are Averroes and Ibn Rushd a doppelganger? Is it a reflected image on the surface of the water, on the surface of the Strait of Gibraltar to a certain extent? Should we keep them distinguished, or should we reunite them, as it seems to me your protagonist, your main character, Adib, is trying to do? And I think there is something that I find really beautiful in your book, is that there is a moment towards the end where the narrator, right, is in solidarity with Adib's attempt. But I think he finds Adib to be obsessed with reconciling the two figures, right? So can you say a little bit about this fracture or this disjunction between Averroes and Ibn Rushd, and how some of your characters like Adib or Aziza, who is perhaps the official historian of the book, and then there is this Dr. Brown, who is a British expert, he's like the Alain de Libera, right, of your novel, right? And so what do we do with this doppelganger, with this strange mirage almost?
Well, thanks very much for this question, because this is a clue and key for this discussion we're having. Very good to know that there are two narrators in the book, Adib and the other narrator who doesn't have a name and who is a translator and preparing a thesis on translation of Averroes. And actually, as you know, the question of the two names is not something that is innocent and that he considers with much more distance than Adib. So actually, when you deconstruct the names, actually maybe what you realize, I would say it in these words. I'll start about who is Averroes. Averroes is a name is a signifier of the philosopher as known by medieval Europe, starting from the 13th century and mainly 14th century, when the university is giving a boost, and mainly Italy, where actually in Roma he was at the end of the 16th century. One of his books was reprinted 10 times in 5 years, just to realize the importance of Averroes. Actually, he was at the same time considered as an alien, as a strange, as an extremist Aristotelian.
Militant, even militant.
By Thomas d'Aquin, by Raymond de Loul, yeah. by other theologians who were quite orthodox. But we shouldn't forget that he was also very much praised by some other theologians, and most importantly, recognized and considered as a source of inspiration by philosophers, Kant, Spinoza, Leibniz. But the thing is, during all this period, from 13th century, let's say 14th century, until 19th century, for five centuries, even if he's referred to, sometimes he's just referred to as the great commentator without the name. Sometimes we have even confusion between Aristotle and between Averroes and Aristotle. And other times we're not all even talking about him. So he's only considered as the one who allowed Aristotle to be known and not considered as a philosopher as such himself. And that's a very important point. And even when in 19th century, there is this Orientalist, I forgot his name,
Renan.
Made his book about Averroes, Renan, Ernest Renan. When Ernest Renan made his book about Averroes, he's just dealing with him as the commentator of Aristotle and not as a philosopher, as an autonomous philosopher who developed his own thinking. So this is Averroes. I mean, at the same time, a source of thinking, the one who allowed, and the one who was considered as not recognizing the Western eye, the Western ego, because he talks about something. He says, "Ça pense en nous." So this collective thinking, this collective self that is looming around us, is something that was considered as very, very strange and even inconceivable from a Christian point of view. And that's what made him very as a foreign thinker and an alien thinker. When you consider Ibn Rushd, from his from the Arab Arabo-Islamic sphere, What do you realize? You realize that first that for more than five centuries, we didn't have the totality of his works. And actually, we didn't have the most daring books by Averroes, by Ibn Rushd.
Like which books do you have in mind here?
Comment on Plato's book of Politics, the Republic. No. Or the Republic, and a very important book, and considered even one maybe one of the reasons of his exile, etc. So his comment on the Book of Nature by Aristotle. All these books were not available, and then we should realize that it's from 19th century that he has been retranslated into Arabic. That's amazing. He's been retranslated into his own language. And then during the 20th century, there have been many, many, many attempts to reconcile with his heritage, but it has been all the time very difficult to achieve for ideological reasons, for political reasons, for by conformism within societies, because also political regimes were standing on a religious basis, etc.
Détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui pleure un rêve qui prendra vie une fois passé Gibraltar. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui se demande si l'histoire le retiendra comme celui qui portait le nom de cette montagne. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui meurt sa vie bête de gangster rappeur. Mais sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune homme qui va naître, qui va être celui que les tours empêchaient d'être. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui boit, dans ce bar où les espoirs se bousculent, une simple canette de Fanta. Il cherche comme un chien sans collier, le foyer qu'il n'a en fait jamais eu, et se dit que peut-être, bientôt, il ne cherchera plus. Et ça rit autour de lui, et ça pleure au fond de lui. Faut rien dire et tout est dit. Et soudain il se fait... Derviche tourneur, il danse sur le bar, il danse, il n'a plus peur. Enfin il hurle comme un fakir, de la vie devient disciple. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, il y a un jeune noir qui prend vie, qui chante, dit enfin je t'aime à cette vie. Puis les autres le sentent, le suivent, ils veulent être or puisqu'ils sont cuivres. Comme ce soleil qui danse, ils veulent se gorger d'étoiles et déchirer à leur tour cette peur qui les voile. Détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui n'est plus esclave, qui crie comme les braves, même la mort n'est plus entrave. Il appelle au courage celles et ceux qui n'ont plus confiance, il dit ramons tous à la même cadence. Dans le bar, y'a un pianiste et le piano est sur les genoux. Le jeune noir tape des mains, hurle comme un fou. Fallait qu'elle sorte cette haine sourde qui le tenait en laisse, qui le démontait pièce par pièce. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y'a un jeune noir qui enfin voit la lune le pointer du doigt et le soleil le prendre dans ses bras. Maintenant il pleure de joie, souffle et se rassoit. Désormais l'amour seul sur lui a des droits. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, un jeune noir prend ses valises, sort du piano bar, échange ses quelques devises. Encore gros d'émotion, il regarde derrière lui et embarque sur le bateau. Il n'est pas réellement tard, le soleil est encore haut. Du détroit de Gibraltar, un jeune noir vogue vers le Maroc tout proche. Vogue vers ce Maroc qui fera de lui un homme sur le détroit de Gibraltar. Sur le détroit de Gibraltar. Vogue vers le merveilleux royaume du Maroc sur le détroit de Gibraltar. Vogue vers le merveilleux royaume du Maroc.
taking this conversation, it seems to me, and this is a term that you use in the book, and I can't remember which narrator talks about a debt philosophique or a philosophical debt. I can't remember if it's Adib or the translator. But it seems to me that you and I also are having this conversation today. I mean, we are pursuing Ibn Rushd and as a cleaved subject from whom we have inherited this notion of the unique intellect, right? Which is extracorporeal, unique and eternal, right? Which is really a proto-modern kind of formulation of what Kant later on will call an idea of history with a cosmopolitan intent, or Spinoza would call God, but the God of Spinoza is nature to a certain extent. There is this idea of a concept of humanity, which is already being, there is an anthropology in Averroes, basically, already at work. There's a tension between the notion of the subject, which is emerging at the time, and at the same time, one of the most beautiful interpretation of Aristotle's De Anima, which is on the soul, right? So there is this tension between soul and subject, right? Is this really what bothers our connationals, our co-religionnaires today? Is the theory of the double truth that Ibn Rushd talked about creating a tension, but also a dialogue between reason or wisdom to a certain extent, the love of wisdom, philosophy, falsafa, right, on the one hand, and theology, right, which would become threatening also in the Latin West. You know, Deleuze and Guattari, for example, in What is Philosophy, there's a section, I think it's chapter 6, they talk about geophilosophy, which I think the Strait of Averroes is a geophilosophical fictionalization of a long series of philosophical debates. But they make a mistake in that book. They say that there is philosophy only in Greece, which to a certain extent they are correct. I mean, philosophia comes from Greece and from the milieu of in imperial tensions between Persia and emerging city-states in Greece. But they don't, and they say, but there is thinking in other parts, other civilization, China, the Arabs, the Indians, and so on. But they say there is no philosophy. I would agree with them, with the exception that there is a falsafa tradition. But not all thinking in the Islamic world is philosophical. So can we talk a little bit about this Greco-Arab tradition, to which I think you are committed to, and certainly your characters are trying to understand how to inherit that heritage. And then on the other hand, there is this persona non grata that Ibn Rushd and Averroes continue to be. Whereas at the same time, as you say very well, towards the end of the book, Ibn Arabi is popular. I'm not particularly a fan of Ibn Arabi for many reasons, because I think that there is an anti-rationalist ethos there that I find problematic, and that there are also some conversations in his Meccan, what is the book? Meccan... Meccan Revelations, where he fantasizes about Ibn Rushd toward the end of his life, being tempted by the mystical way, right? I don't have anything against mysticism, but I have a problem with anti-rationalist mysticism. So it's very complicated, and we are still wrestling with this inheritance. Has there been a moment in which Ibn Rushd and Averroes have been welcomed in the Islamic West?
Very, very importantly, about mysticism. Just one thing. In the novel, Adib, at a certain time when he was still young, he was looking for the place where Ibn Rushd was buried when he was in Marrakesh, and actually, the place where he was buried when he was taken away It was replaced by a mystical figure, very important mystical figure, Abul Abbas Sibti. And the metaphor of the mystic taking the place of the philosopher maybe says something about our anthropological history.
Yeah.
That's that's one thing I wanted to underline. Second, on the Greek Arab relationship with philosophy, it's very important to bear in mind that of course during the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, the Muslim Empire is becoming dominant, powerful, and one of the elements of power was translation first of science, astronomy, physics, etc., and then philosophy. So the school of Baghdad was the locus of translation of philosophy, translating Aristotle, Plato through Plotin, and it's very important also to bear in mind that from this place in Baghdad, we are even when philosophers will start or al-falasifa. So the word falsafa is not an Arab word. It's a
neologism
has been coined. It's a neologism that has been coined, but I mean, we're only talking about al-hikmah, which is wisdom, while philosophy is the love of wisdom. We were talking about wisdom, not love of wisdom. And then we coined this word, falsafa. And the falsafa in the eastern parts of Islam, at that time, al-Farabi, Ibn Sina, who were the most important ones, we're looking for a conciliation between the Oriental Gnosis, Gnostic tradition, and the Greek philosophy. And the particularity of Averroes being in the Western part of Islam, 2 centuries later, is that he went into a much more rationalist position in his interpretation and in his thinking. So that's a very important. One of the, there were in the 20th century, you realize that some thinkers tried either from an ideological or from just a cultural or intellectual point of view to try to give a rebirth to Averroes. I can talk about thinkers like Sadık Jalal Azm in Syria. I can talk about Mohamed Abdel Jabri in Morocco, and others. You can name them. The thing is, the most important ones that were following this path were not necessarily in the establishment and were not considered as welcome enough. And to me, the most important thing question is how to introduce this thinking and the paradigms of thinking of Averroes within the school system and within the transmission of knowledge. And the most important ideas, which are sort of pre-secular ideas, are the question of the oldness of the world and the fact that the sempiternality of the world, this is a very important notion, which means that actually God is just the first energy, just giving the first energy, is not a legislator and not a being giving order, but it's just the first energy. And this idea is very much linked to the notions that were developed by other philosophers in Europe during the Enlightenment. And the second is the double truth. And I think these two ideas were very much developed by secular thinkers and not very much considered by regimes that had a religious background, or that were using religion as a way to give legitimacy to power.
Which is the other side of the Averroist coin, is the fact that we don't want to give the impression to our audience that Averroes was just a marginal figure. Averroes and Ibn Rushd was the son of came from an important notable family during both the Almoravid and the Almohad dynasties, 11th, 12th century. He also occupied important political positions. He was a jurist. He was the great Qadi of Seville, right?
And of Cordoba.
Of Cordoba. His native Cordoba, of course. So here we are in a situation that also to me reminded me of an important text by Immanuel Kant, What is the Enlightenment? In which Kant articulates a compromise or a kind of a situation in which the price to pay to think freely is to maintain an adjacent position with the powers that be, right? So Averroes, like his father and grandfather, like Ibn Tufayl, who is one of my favorite thinkers of that period, in addition to Ibn Bajjah, these were thinkers who were trying to negotiate the relationship between a thinker and the social context in which the thinker lived. So there is this relationship that Kant talks, the relationship between the public and the private use of reason, right? So Ibn Bajjah had found an interesting solution to this. You become a solitary in an urban context, right? So it's the rule of the solitary, which I think is a marvelous book. Ibn Tufayl takes almost a rationalist and mystical kind of direction in Ibn Yaqdan, right? Which is the forerunner of Robinson Crusoe to a certain extent, where there is a kind of an autodidact natural education that takes place on a deserted island, right, away from the city, republic, and so on. And Averroes, it seems to me, or Ibn Rushd, is a synthesis of these two positions, right? He works for the Almohads. But the Almohads eventually turn their back on him and, exile him in Lucera, right? Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about how Ibn Rushd moves from being this powerful public intellectual almost to becoming an excommunicated thinker in Marrakesh, shipped back on a mule through the Strait of Gibraltar?
Well, it's very important to bear in mind one thing. Averroes did not live in an agora like Aristotle did. This is a very important point. I mean, we are in a period where he's talking to a happy few people about his most daring ideas. And then he has another type of discourse to the layman. So this is important to bear in mind. And this is the paradigm, this is the episteme of this era. I mean, he's even going beyond what could be allowed then, because he was thinking about transmission and etc., but he thought that he cannot confuse the layman with metaphysics, but he wanted to have some enlightened elites that would allow ideas to bit by bit to be shared. So this is one point that I wanted to clarify. Second, yes, he's the son, and even his grandfather was already the Qadi, was already the Grand Qadi of Sevilla. His father was a theologian, and he makes part of a notable family, very much respected. And it's very much to bear in mind that when there will be battles around the rulers, of course, the power of families is very important, and the competition between these families counts as much as ideas. So that's one point to bear in mind. Second, you were talking about Ibn Tufayl. Ibn Tufayl was also the doctor, the Sultan's doctor, a special doctor, and he was the one who introduced Ibn Rushd to Abu Yaqub Yusuf. Abu Yaqub Yusuf was a learned Sultan. He knew the Greeks. He knew philosophy, and he was the one who sponsored Ibn Rushd's comments. But then he was a qadi. He was listening to people, and he was an uncorrupt person. Ibn Rushd was known as an uncorrupt person, and he was very much fighting for justice. So very much interested by this idea of virtuous city.
From Al-Farabi, right? Did he retake
from Al-Farabi? Yeah. From Al-Farabi, and also even when he made of the Republic, he transposed the soul by the city, and then this shows you the importance of justice in his thinking. Then, so the idea that there was a Yaqub al-Mansur who came later, who was more of a warrior, less learned than his father, who was during this period where we had crusades, and the power of the theologians and the mystics was getting much more important. So the rational philosopher became the scapegoat, and then you can find the pretext. It was sent to Lucena. Lucena was a very small village where we exiled the Jews then. So it shows you how he was made out of the nation. He was sent out of the nation, out of the Ummah. So this is very, very, very violent. And then he was in residence in Marrakesh. So the decline of Abarwais comes from the fact there is no agora. We're not in a democracy. We have competition between big families. We have his book on politics, commentary. Actually, his comment on the Republic is also a disguised critic of the Almohads. That's quite important. I mean, this shows you also how he had a position of a humanist, honest man. He was not a man of power. He had a coalition, as you said very rightly. We are in a period where we had to be sponsored by princes. The big difference is that starting from 13th century, 14th century, development of the universities in the Western world will be the place that will protect thinkers, which is something that we didn't develop enough in the Muslim world. Actually, the universities were developed, but were still under the power of theologians, and not disconnected from the theological power.
So we maybe one or two more points, and then we can conclude. To me, it seems to me that conceptually speaking, I think that we tend to think of Ibn Rushd and Averroes as you were saying at the beginning of the conversation today, as a commentator of Aristotle. And we think of him as a militant Aristotelician, right? I mean, even Ernest Bloch, you know, in his book, Avicenna and the Left-Wing Aristotelians, I mean, at least I see myself in that political camp, suggests to me that Averroes is perhaps not just a rationalist, that Averroes has also a foot in the empiricist tradition. And of course, we don't have to polarize between rationalism and empiricism. That's a trajectory that it takes in the Latin West and in Europe later on. But I think that the fact that he translated and commented on, Plato's Republic, right? Because Aristotle's Politics was not available, suggests that, you know, he did write and engage Plato, right? Which is the source of the Neoplatonic tradition through Plotinus and so on. So on the one hand, we have Avicenna, who understands the production and generation of existence in the world as an emanation from a divine source, right? So it starts from God, and then there is this hierarchy of existence. It seems to me that Ibn Rushd, certainly in the commentary on the great commentary on the Anima, is an empiricist in that he starts with the sensible. He starts from the imagination. There is a great deal of importance of images in Averroes. So he's someone who also is a contributor and an innovator of what we call faculty theory, right? So the play between the sensible, the imagination, reason, memory. But what he does, and this is why this show is called Radio Cogitation, but he zooms in on cogitation as, for him, the most important faculty within the human soul, right? So cogitation is this link between the empirical and the rational. It's this link between images and reason to a certain extent, right? Or concepts. So I like this idea of the Strait of Averroes as an exercise in Ibn Rushdian cogitation. It's a moment also of the very kind of speculation that Averroes is absolutely against in most of his writings. So cogitation becomes this, and I think Jean-Baptiste Brenet, to a certain extent, I think, makes a good point about this particular point. It's that cogitation is a malleable faculty. It can be ijtihad, right? Ijtihad is intellectual struggle, but it can also mean mourning. It can also mean being in love. It means many things. Right? So I like this idea of, so there is the modernist recuperation of Averroes. I don't think that's our generation, please. I think that, you know, with all the respect that I have for Jabri and the critique of Arab reason, those are very important, you know, interventions. Or the Nahda's position vis-a-vis Averroes, for example, right? It seems to me that what this conversation that you are opening with your book is a search for a contemporary Averroes or a contemporary Ibn Rushd, okay? Just like we talk about, a shift from modern art to contemporary art, right? And it's not by accident that many contemporary artists, you know, in Morocco, like Mohsen Harraki, who's a young and very intelligent artist, or in Italy, and someone that I'm in dialogue with, someone from the 60s, Giulio Paolini, who made several pieces as homage to Averroes, because in Italy also has to do its work on its position vis-a-vis Averroes. It's a love-hate relationship, right? So I think the conclusion of your book is that there is an errancy, an errance. There is a metamorphosis, right? That Adib, perhaps in an excess of modernist, Arab modernism, wants to give too much of an identity to Averroes, whereas Averroes is this malleable doppelganger, right? So if you want to say something about this, just by way of concluding.
Well, I would love to talk about Nadia. Who is the most contemporary character in the book? Who is a student following Adib's courses, and actually she makes part of this new generation who are rather postmodern, trying to take elements of legacy from here and there in order to remember, in the sense that what Yongo gives to remember with a with the hyphen, to remember the elements of this endogenous modernity. And what Ibn Rushd allows for, and you're totally right, is the fact that he's very much attached to observation and to empirical observation and to the proof of truth, and not for only the abstract truth. And being attached to the proof of truth and not for the abstract truth or the speculative truth that the theologians would think about, etc., is something that gives him much more weight in the tradition, in the scientific tradition, in the epistemological tradition of rethinking relationship with the world, with the universe, and with realities and with complex realities. So this is to me very important. And actually, just to finish on this point, it's thanks to young people like Nadia, who were discussing very openly while I was the curator of the Night of Philosophers in Rabat, that I met these people just discussing it very openly, that they gave me the inspiration to write this book. I wrote this book for these young people, not for even myself. I can say that I try to think of what we can write about where we are and where we are as part of the world and as part of thinking the world. And these young people are engaged into this because through internet, through horizontality of knowledge that is shared today, they are not engaged into a traditional sequential learning of knowledge, but in a more puzzle-like understanding of their heritage. And that's to me was very stimulating.
And and I think what I find also quite interesting in the book is that these rereadings, these reconfiguration of the philosophical heritage, and this this curation of the figure of Averroes and Ibn Rushd as a doppelganger happens in your book through media forms and media technologies. So there is the radio, right, which is really where the university is substituted, where there is a different type of transmission network which is enabled. And then towards the end, when you talk about the Nadia's friends and colleagues who migrate to the internet, right, and to create a blog and chat rooms in which they discuss the future of this kind of radical thinking, I really appreciate the way you bring in radio and new media as a way of thinking a future that is still yet to be imagined. And I think that your book is a wonderful contribution to that reimagination. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much. That was very, very pleasant and very enriching and stimulating. Thanks.